This is Dr. Allie Evans welcoming you to Light on Health, a show where we shine the light on a full spectrum of topics that affect your health and that of our entire community. My guest today is Glenn Leachman, and we're going to be talking about how we deal with big emotions, talking about anxiety, depression, grief, and really how we alleviate suffering both in us and in the global world. So Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Allie. It's great to be here.
Glenn is a licensed psychologist. He got his PhD in London, England, and he also is a fifth degree black belt in Aikido, which is a really interesting, you get the best of both worlds.
Get the mental and the physical.
That's right. He's also a father of three, a grandfather of two, which might be more important, right?
Right now.
And he's been here for about, you've been on the coast for
12 years.
12 years, yeah. Well, so tell us a little bit about how did you get this calling and how did you get interested in working with people and their feelings and emotions and, you know, alleviating suffering?
It started really when I was traveling in Asia. After I'd gotten my doctorate and I'd already been teaching, I felt there was something more. And I had wound up in a monastery in Sri Lanka where I did a lot of meditation. And you could also see the problems people were having. And you could feel a way that just letting the emotions come in and pass was the most helpful thing going on. I could see my own rising. And without doing anything about them, they would pass. This seemed really a very helpful and unique perspective. And then traveling through India, where you see so much suffering, the feeling was, wow, when I get back to the West, I would like to be of more service. It also was informed when my mother died when I was 22. The way that she died, no one ever told her she was dying, and it seemed not the most sympathetic way to approach. And I wanted to be able to be more open with emotions. And so when I came back, I got involved working with hospice as a volunteer and as a consultant as a way to work with people's suffering and see what I could do to help. And I also worked with people in the criminal justice system with drug and alcohol problems and found that just allowing them to learn how to be more mindful would be a good start.
And do you think in your own case with your mom, did they not let her know because there was that fear surrounding death and we don't talk about it? Was it a stigma or was it?
It wasn't at that time back in 1970, it wasn't done. It wasn't, mm-hmm. You didn't tell people, oh, you're going to die so that everyone could be informed. And it felt, it just didn't feel as genuine. It's a difficult thing to do,
right?
To actually sit and know and be conscious and aware. But it was a more humane thing, and working with hospice and working in as a frontline like social worker, I found that to be so helpful to work with and see what we could do with human suffering.
Yeah, and I think I'm curious what your opinion is, but I know when I'm working with my patients, and lots of people come in with anxiety, depression, apathy. Anger, you know, emotions are a normal part of our life, and lots of people come in with these. It seems to me that the most suffering happens by fighting the emotions. So we label happiness, joy, ecstasy, contentment. We label all these as good, and then we label anger, grief, depression, anxiety, sadness as bad. And we kind of spend, I think as a society, we spend our life fighting the bad ones and trying to resist them and make them go away. And it seems to me that a lot of the suffering comes from the fight, the battle of trying to make these ones we perceive as bad go away.
And the most helpful thing, and certainly in mindfulness meditation, is you notice the emotions and then you just label them and let them go, let them pass. So you notice the anxiety and then you let it pass, or you notice the sadness and you let it pass. Rumi, the Sufi poet, wrote a wonderful poem called The Guest House, in which he encouraged us to invite all the emotions into our guest house and welcome them and turn nobody away, even if they're, a row of sorrows. Right. You let them in and welcome them all, and one isn't better than the next. And that as soon as we try to fight with the emotion, that's when we wind up getting stuck, because we engage it rather than letting it go. So the more we can just notice it, the easier it will be. I had an experience when I was in the monastery where, because we were encouraged to sit still, a mosquito was buzzing in my ear. So I was going noticing, buzzing. And the next thing was biting, and the next thing was itching, and I had this tremendous desire to scratch. But I was just noticing it, and the next thing, within 5 minutes, the itching had gone away. And when my hour meditation was over, I couldn't even find the spot where the mosquito had landed, mm-hmm. and I had done nothing. And I thought of all those hours I had spent trying to brush the mosquito away from my ear, or trying to scratch or not scratch, and how, by engaging with it, made it much worse than just noticing it and letting it pass. And that was a most educational experience of that whole training.
I've heard a book that I was reading, that's the teachings of Pema Chodron, who's the Buddhist monk. Mm-hmm. In one of her books, she talks about when we, you know, I think people, when we use the word meditation, people are like, well, I don't have an hour to sit and cross my legs and put my fingers together and be silent, you know. And people often with meditation, it's like, oh, okay, I think it's been 25 minutes. And they look at the clock and it's been 22 seconds.
Yes.
And they're like, am I done yet? But in this book, she talks about how it can literally be a 2-minute practice. And the idea sometimes is, in your day, as you notice an emotion come up, so you're going about your day and you start to feel really overwhelmed with your to-do list. You know, yes. It's just too big and I'm not getting things done, and some time's passing, that you, kind of like you were saying, you picture it almost like, she explains it like a bubble that's just floating by. You just put a bubble around it and you don't label it as good or bad. You just observe.
Just let it.
This is my thought.
It's just what it is.
Yeah, this thought came up and I feel overwhelmed, and you let that bubble just kind of float on by, and then you keep walking, and you know, then maybe that same bubble, which likely I think will come up every 20 seconds.
Try not to pass the judgment on what the feeling is.
Right.
And just sit with it.
Right.
And in that same fashion, as a therapist being in the room, the most helpful thing you can do for someone is to be a non-anxious presence mm-hmm. with that patient, because what they're feeling is, I'm so anxious or I'm so depressed, I cannot tolerate this feeling, and I don't think anybody else can tolerate mm-hmm. being around me. And when they come into your office and you are just a non-anxious presence, accepting them as they are, it helps them to be able to sit with their own emotions. Since you're not seeming particularly disturbed by their emotions, it helps them to, oh, maybe it is okay. Maybe right. I'm all right.
Right. And probably some of their suffering is coming from labeling themselves as bad or not good enough or stuck in this rut or...
Exactly. And that I will like myself when I'm a different person.
Yes.
The person who comes in and says, well, I don't like myself now, but I'll like myself when I lose 15 or 20 pounds.
Right.
The question is, well, what would it take to like yourself now? Because if you don't like yourself now, why do you think it'll be you'll like yourself later?
Right.
You're going to spend a long time. What if you never lose those 20 pounds? You're going to spend the rest of your life unhappy. You might just as well decide, well, I like myself now, and I might like myself better, or I might not like myself better after I lose that weight, but I'm okay now.
And it seems like our society is such a if and when society. Like, if I can only get my house cleaned up and my, you know, my job organized, then I'll be able to go on this hike I've wanted to do. You know, if I do this, then I'll do this. And it's almost, I feel like it's reinforced by media too. You know, if you have this sports car, well, then you'll get this, you know, gorgeous partner.
That's
if
right.
You have...
And then you buy the sports car and you discover nothing, it doesn't help. What's the next thing I'm going to have to buy? That's
yeah.
right. As opposed to, I'm okay right now. I'm okay the way I am. This is good.
But that internal work of looking within instead of without is really, it seems like we really have to swim against the tide to do it in our society. I mean, I feel like it's so much of this is what you're wearing, what you're driving, who you associate with. I mean, we have our cultures very external in terms of we identify with how the world sees us. I think to do this inner work that you're talking about, it's really swimming upstream.
It's a challenge.
Yeah.
To not have those desires, to right. think that I will be happier when I get A, B, or C, but to accept the fact that I'm just going to be okay the way I am.
Well, and I think that notion also, it's like we visualize things as having an end point. You know, I'll lose the 15 pounds, I'll get the sports car, I'll get the new job. Hmm. But really, you know, the only thing that's consistent is change. So even you might get the sports car, but then you might lose that sports car. You know, you might have an accident.
And then you may be unhappy because you got attached to the sports car.
Right.
And the biggest cause of suffering is that, what you were saying, impermanence, mm-hmm. the fact that nothing lasts, as opposed to it could be also the greatest cause of comfort, because just as the happiness won't last forever, neither will the unhappiness. Right. If you could remember, if people could remember, if we could all remember that no matter how anxious or depressed I am today, in the next moment, it's going to change. It's not going to last. And that's the comfort, is that we notice these states, but they're not going to last forever.
Right.
So it's the biggest thing that can help us to accept what is, because it's not going to last anyway.
And when people, I find with a lot of my patients, they get that kind of repetitive thought patterns where, you know, especially if you're feeling extreme anxiety, you get these repetitive patterns of thoughts of, you know, I can't do this, this is too much, I can't function. Do you have tools that you use or ideas you have for breaking that pattern, like breaking that kind of hamster wheel of thoughts that keep going and going?
It's not so much the breaking the hamster wheel as is to let the hamster wheel run and not be obsessed by it. And so one of the things that after my mother died, when I was feeling anxious and depressed during the next year, I discovered that if I did something like shooting baskets, which I was particularly good at as a kid growing up, if I went to the gym and picked up a basketball and began to sink baskets and have that experience of mastery, then that hamster wheel thought could run on itself while my body was re-engaging in a feeling of competency and mastery. And within a half hour or 45 minutes, I found that the hamster wheel was calming down because I wasn't having to pay attention to it, nor was I having to try to do something that the hamster wheel was getting in the way of me being able to focus. So I have found, for myself and for my patients, helping people to perform overlearned tasks. For some people, it's knitting. Some people, it'll be walking in the woods. Somebody else, it might be swimming. Someone else, it might be playing the fiddle. Something that you know how to do. Everybody knows how to do something without having to think about it. And that way, the hamster wheel kind of dissipates and doesn't be the controller or the driver.
And is it, do you think in that case it's a physical activity? Do you think it's actually moving some part of your body, or does it not necessarily need to be?
It doesn't necessarily have to be. Mm-hmm. It depends what you have overlearned. I'm a physical person, so right. I find for me it's helpful to do physical tasks, swimming, walking, doing Aikido, martial arts.
Yeah.
But for other people, it might be something more sedentary. It might be meditating, for instance, right. if that's an overlearned task for you.
But maybe the goal is that you don't have to use your logical brain. You don't have to use those. The neurons are already over-firing, and that you don't have to
correct
go there. You
yes.
You can go from rote and go from become instinctual.
And those instinctual overlearned tasks are the ones that we can do without having to go to that left side of our brain where we have to be organized to say, how do I, you know, I used to say it was like, don't try to program your VCR when you're having an anxious day. Yeah. Shows you how old I am, because who programs
a VCR
anymore? So
it makes me think of, I was attending a birth a couple of years ago, and the mother who was having the baby, her mother was there in the house, and she was just extremely anxious. She was so nervous. It was her daughter having this baby. And she was knitting, and she just kept knitting and knitting, kind of frantically, you know, as frantic as you can picture knitting. And it was a long birth, then it was a long labor, and she had made this scarf that was just, it was sort of this like wedding train.
The endless scarf.
But the think in doing it, you know, it was the process, not the end product, you know.
The more she knitted, the calmer she felt.
In the end, you could have like put the scarf around the house, you know.
But. That's a great story. What an image.
Yes.
Oh.
So we're talking with Glenn Leachman about big emotions and managing how we feel. I'm Dr. Allie Evans, and this is Light on Health.
שלשום, וזה אותו כחול גדול, אותו עוף בשמיים, אותו עלה של זית אל מחר נוטה ליבול. אז בוא נתפור את הקרח, אשליה שבגבולות. שמפרידה עיניים.
You're listening to Light on Health on Coast Community Radio. Glenn Leachman and I are talking about big emotions and how we navigate the world of emotions, especially in our society where we fight so much of the emotions that don't feel comfortable to us, and how we alleviate some of this suffering. Glenn, what do you think? I think, you know, especially you've traveled, I've traveled a lot. When I travel in other cultures, it's really obvious certain cultures don't feel the same sense of anxiety and depression that I think we feel in America. You know, sometimes you can be in, like you said, you can be in India or you can be in some places. I traveled in Africa where people really don't have a lot, but yet you see them as so happy and easygoing and kind of not so concerned with all life's little, you know, anxieties. What do you think is happening what do you think is happening in America, in our culture, in our society?
I think it's the fragmentation. Two or three generations ago, people lived in multi-generational family units. A generation later, it was just a nuclear family unit. And today, there are more single people living in big cities in America. I think Seattle, San Francisco are like number one and number two. I think New York's pretty high up there, where there are people living out solitary lives. And one of the most helpful things with depression is to not be alone, to be in a community. And so I think what's happened in America is we've just gotten fragmented.
People are
sitting watching television alone, or the ubiquitous cell phone that everyone is sitting playing on, and it's not helping us to become community where we get that sense of relationship. Studies of happiness and longevity find that people who have contact on a regular basis with their neighbors, that there's a sense of we're in this together. When you go to a third world country and you go to a village, you see people that are interacting, and of course that's when they're happiest. And then when you find particularly the elderly who are isolated, that's where a lot of dis-ease occurs.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And we spend all this, like all these resources. It's like you move into a new house and the first thing people do is put a fence up right between you and your neighbor.
So that we can be more isolated.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think that idea, oftentimes, like if you find yourself in a state of depression, I think connecting to others is one of the hardest things. It's almost like you have to just force it when it feels the most uncomfortable.
Because you feel so ashamed of your own
depression.
You don't want anyone else to be a witness to it. And that's the time when you really need your friends.
Right.
The psychologist James Hillman wrote a lot about the relationship between depression and being in community. And he spent a lot of the last part of his life working in community, in the men's retreats with the poet Robert Bly, and always talking about how we will be happier if we are in a larger community.
And it's interesting. I think, you know, we talked about this a bit in the beginning, but that idea of each emotion, you know, kind of like what you said about the guest house. Like, if you're an innkeeper, you don't judge who comes into your inn. You just give service to each person who's paying for the room for the night. And I think that idea of each emotion, not only just allowing it to be, but actually honoring that it has a positive intent and a purpose.
Completely. Because that's they do serve a function. If we didn't feel anxious at certain times, we might not survive.
Right.
Because some situations are dangerous. The difficulty we're having today is that people are feeling anxious at times when there isn't anything external. So it's an internal state of not feeling safe that we have to try to explore and help people learn to be to sit with it. I think that when you're sometimes there's an edge between anxiety and adventure or anxiety and excitement, that for one person something unknown is very exciting, for someone else the unknown is very anxious. And what is it that causes it to be one way or versus the other? And it's worth exploring people's anxiety to see, is there another way to look at that than
right.
the way you're stuck at the moment?
And I would imagine in your career, it's also encouraging people to explore it and not resist it.
My job is to ask good questions. It's not always easy to think of what the right question or the good question is, but it's never to encourage someone to be other than they are, but to ask the questions to help them explore what is it that's going on with you right now. Well, you know, why are you feeling what you're feeling, or tell me where you're feeling what you're feeling, what part of your body, so that they can be more curious about the feeling state. Because it's, you know, if it's what's going on, we have to be able to be okay with that.
Right. And it's, you know, oftentimes, especially with people that really, you know, sometimes you see with depression that there's really is a biochemical imbalance in the brain, you know, and sometimes when you're looking at these like deep seated emotional states that people can kind of get stuck in, it's also, I think there's also a piece of honoring what is, and that this is part of their purpose on their life journey, is to work through this and be in this and learn what they need to learn from it and, you know, do what they need to do in it and then move on. But that it's like to honor that this is, it's not just bad luck and it's not just random, oh, I happen to be depressed, woe is me, but really to be grateful that it's teaching some lesson and learn that lesson and then move past.
And figure out what the lesson is.
Yes. There's, I've been reading this book called The Language of Emotions by Carla McLaren, and it's what your feelings are trying to tell you. But I love, she kind of breaks down each emotion and tells you what is the positive intent of this emotion? What's the purpose of this emotion? So for like depression, for example, she calls it ingenious stagnation, and that the gift of it is that it's a brilliant stop sign of the soul. And I think sometimes, you know, the immediate label of depression is like, oh no, make it go away. This is dark. This is uncomfortable. This is a lack of light. And she talks about that kind of listening closely, realizing there's always a reason for the energy and flow to leave, and to kind of look for those answers, and that you can't really just push past it without diving deeper to understand it.
And yet when most people come into their physician saying they're depressed, almost the first thing the physician does is get out their prescription pad to say, well, which antidepressant can I prescribe to you? Which is in itself a statement that there's something wrong with what you're feeling, because we have to make it go away as soon as possible.
As soon as possible, right.
Rather than saying, well, let's explore that. You know, let's talk about why you're feeling that way. It won't last forever. It is not that I'm saying that it's not okay to take medication. It's just that if it's the first thing that's offered, the message is this emotion is not okay.
It's also a very, it seems to me, it's also a very passive way of treatment, in the sense of like it doesn't really empower the person to do anything.
It doesn't teach any tools.
Right.
Whereas what we need are the tools to help us to manage our anxiety, tools to manage our depression. And those tools are just, you know, for each individual, you have to find what is it that's going to help me to be more comfortable with what I'm feeling.
That's right.
Which actually kind of is a perfect segue for me to talk a little bit about Aikido,
okay.
Because I've been studying Aikido since I went to Japan in 1979 and saw these graceful movements. It's the martial art of peace and harmony, and Aiki in the Aikido means the blending between two people. We're trying to get into a state of Aiki, so that it's a way of learning how to be in non-conflict with people. And so much of our life is spent in conflict, whether it's with our neighbors, with our children, with our in-laws,
with ourselves.
And when we practice, what we're practicing is movements that help us to harmonize. So I have a dojo here on Willapa Bay, and I have one in Seattle also. And people come in there and learn how to do these repetitive movements, which are very calming, in a interactive way that helps reduce anxiety and depression. Everyone who comes into the dojo, when they leave an hour or hour and a half later, you can see the difference in their face, have a big smile on their face. They've gone inside. They've embodied. They've felt things. So you're trying to be more mindful as you're moving rather than less mindful. And one of my peeves is people are going into gyms, getting on exercises, and watching television and reading a magazine, so that you actually check out of your body while you're moving your body, rather than going inside and noticing how it feels when you're riding that exercise. How does it feel when you're on that Stairmaster? And it may well be boring, and that's why you want to make the time pass quicker, but all you're doing is you're training yourself to be disembodied rather than training yourself to be more embodied. The more we're in touch with our inner selves, the more we get comfortable with it, the happier we're going to be, the more conscious we're going to be, the more we'll be able to manage those uncomfortable emotions.
And as you're saying that, it's reminding me what we're talking about. It's like that graceful movement, even with Aikido. Isn't that just what we want to do with our world of emotions? Just gracefully let it all flow through, whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether it's scary, whether it's uncomfortable.
That's what we're trying. And then we also have to be able to accept when we're not being graceful.
Right.
Because, it's all going to be, we have to accept it all. But clearly, we admire and we feel better when we feel that state of grace in ourselves.
Right. Do you have any favorite kind of resources, books, TED Talks, any resources that you would want to share with listeners?
It's a really good question. I'm always loath to recommend anything because it's going to set it up where, I have to go read that.
Yes,
because
right.
I think people need to find their own resources. I've always believed that finding a good poetry or good literature is the most helpful thing, and people just have to discover for themselves what works. What works for me may not work for you.
Right.
I've gotten more out of reading Tolstoy, for instance, than I did by reading any of the psychology textbooks when I was an undergraduate.
Yes. So. And there is that tendency to kind of go too far into the left logical brain and not even feel the emotions of the right brain when we read too much about it.
Yep.
Yeah,
I think that's true.
And if people want to find out a little more about Aikido?
We have a Facebook page, Aikido Willapa Bay, and a website. And I encourage anyone who's interested.
And you spell Aikido.
A-I-K-I-D-O. And check us out. And
Aikido Willapa Bay.
Aikido Willapa Bay.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And any last minute parting words of advice?
It's not so much advice, but one of the things about being trained as a therapist, you go to school to become a therapist, but no one ever teaches you at the hardest thing to do as a therapist, which is to be a helpless witness to the negative consequences people get from actions they take, and that there really isn't anything as a therapist we can do to make someone not get those negative consequences, but to accept just how helpless as a therapist one is. As I said, all you can do is really be a non-anxious presence in the face of someone's suffering,
right.
And to be that witness to whatever goes on in their life. That is, and in a way, that's what we're trying to teach ourselves,
okay.
Is to be able to accept when we're helpless and when we None of us like feeling helpless.
No. So our message is to push into the discomfort.
That's right. Live in the discomfort.
That's right. You've been listening to Light on Health with my guest, Glenn Leachman. Thank you very much, Glenn. And a very special thank you to our generous engineer, Kate Brister.
Thank you, Allie. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yes, sir. Yo.